Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Joining us by phone with a friend, we've got Buck Chino of Work in Progress Radio. Buck, welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Charles, always.
Buck, it's always a pleasure to have you. Hey, listen, you brought a friend. You got the afternoon. What's going on?
Well, we have Tom Good. He's the resident officer of the National Labor Relations Board office in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Tom, welcome to the Union Edge. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Hello, Buck and Charles, and hello to the Union Edge audience.
It's great to have you. Great to have you. You know, Tom, oftentimes we talk about, our not yet union brothers and sisters, and we talk a little bit about their efforts to become union or their rights as workers. But union workers also have protection from the National Labor Relations Board, too, right?
Oh, most certainly.
And one of the things that seen this process once or twice in my day, but there's an issue that's called duty of fair representation. And first of all, it's not really mentioned in the Act. Where does it come from?
That you're right. There is the National Labor Relations Act does not use that phrase, but shortly after the Act was created, a series of court decisions, including some Supreme Court decisions, derived from the language of the statute a duty of fair representation that unions owe to the employees that they represent when they are recognized or when they're voted in. And some of these cases arose not under the National Labor Relations Act, but under a sister statute, the Railway Labor Act. There was a Supreme Court case in 1944 called Steele versus Louisville and Nashville Railroad. And that was a case in which unions haven't always acted with the best of intentions for their members. In some instances, this is a case in which African American railroad worker, an employee, challenged a contract that had been negotiated that required the railroad to stop hiring African Americans until white employees made up the majority in each job category. Well, the Supreme Court recognized that was not only patently unfair, but it violated the spirit of the Railway Labor Act and, by derivation, the National Labor Relations Act as well. That under the Railway Labor Act, just like under the NLRA, when a union is voted in, it is the exclusive representative. Employees have to look to that union and that union only to represent their interests. And the Supreme Court said that, well, that charter that is granted or recognized by the government carries with it an obligation on the part of the union to be fair to the employees that it represents.
So what you're saying is that correct me if I'm wrong, is that the employees basically have a right to engage with other unions? Is that what you're saying or not?
Well, employees always have the right to decide at what level they want to participate in their union. If a union is certified by the government to be their representative or is lawfully recognized by their employer, then we have a principle in this country, in our labor relations policy, called exclusive representation. One union at a time. Only one union can represent a group of employees. And employees are always free to maybe to seek other union representation, although not during the term of a contract, or at least the first 3 years of a contract. But at various times, employees have the right to seek different union representation, or maybe to vote a union out. But when the union is in, when the union is either certified or is lawfully recognized, the only one union can represent those employees, and that carries with it the responsibility to be fair to those employees. They can't shop around for a different union to represent them if there's one union that is lawfully in place.
Well, what kind of cases come from the you know, the duty of fair representation? I mean,
yeah, by far the most common case that comes to us is in the context of a grievance procedure. When a union represents employees and they have a contract with their employer that spells out a grievance procedure, typically it has two or three or four steps before there's an agreement to go to arbitration for those tough grievances that can't be negotiated between the employer and the union. And if employees are disappointed, or if they feel frustrated, or if they feel they've been unfairly treated by their union in the grievance procedure, maybe the union didn't take the grievance as far as the employee wanted, or maybe the employee feels that there was some personal factors that entered into the decision of the union to maybe settle the grievance against their interests. They might come to the NLRB and file a charge accusing the union of violating that duty. That is the way the case. Most of the cases that come to us with this issue arise in the context of a grievance procedure.
So what's the process then, Tom? I mean, what you as the board have to decide or investigate whether you have basically something that's a true case, or it's a disgruntled employee that things didn't go their way, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. When an individual files a charge with us saying, "Hey, I believe my union violated its duty to fairly represent me," they would file a charge. We would send a copy to the union to let the union know that we're starting an investigation. The employer, by the way, also gets a copy of that charge. So both the employer and the union are aware right from the start that the charge has been made. An NLRB investigator would arrange an appointment with the employee and conduct a fairly detailed interview. We want to know what are all the facts that the employee has in her possession. Were you disciplined? Okay, let's say you were disciplined for violating the employer's attendance policy. Is it a point-based system? Yes. How many points did you have, and when on what days did you accumulate those points? That's the level of detail we would get into. And as we do with most of our cases, we always try to get a sworn statement from our witnesses. So we get the evidence in black and white. And after hearing what the employee has to say about the facts, we would ask, why do you believe that the union violated its duty of fair representation? Sometimes they don't have much in the way of a theory. Sometimes they just had wished for a better outcome. But sometimes they have evidence or a strong suspicion and a lead of where the evidence could be found, showing that maybe there were some unfair considerations that the union officers used in deciding not to process the grievance. Some examples from my own career. This is going way back, but I had a case once where an employee had been discharged. And he felt that the union didn't represent him, and part of the reason why he suspected the union hadn't represented him very well is because the local president's wife had left the local president and was now living with him. So there was some that hurt. So there was something that had to be investigated there. Did the local president participate in the decision to stop the grievance after the third step and not to appeal it to arbitration? Any sort of an unfair or unreasonable or discriminatory consideration that enters the decision-making process of that the union makes, or how are we going to handle this grievance, could be the basis for a duty of fair representation unfair labor practice charge.
So that is basically, of course, there's a long list, right? Discrimination and things like that also fall into this category?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Anything that is unrelated to the merits of the grievance and the factors on the job. So if people come to us and say I think the union violated my right. They didn't handle my grievance because I don't get along with the steward, or because I feel there's been discrimination on the basis of my race or my age, or perhaps because I'm not a union member. Maybe I don't participate in the meetings. Maybe I've actually resigned my membership in the union. Unions owe that same duty of fair representation even to those members or those employees in the bargaining unit who are not union members.
This can be kind of a long drawn out affair. Then this is not just because what you have to do, right? It's the same kind of process. You have to do the investigation, and that may call into effect. It would call into other members, right? I mean, that can attest one way or the other.
Certainly,
and then basically after you've gathered all the evidence, then you make a decision. Correct.
That's correct, and we would of course always give the union an opportunity to respond to the charge, to present their evidence and their arguments, and the requirements of due process. In every case, we have to give the charged party an opportunity to be heard and to present their side of the story. But at the end of the investigation, if it looks to us like it looks like the union maybe did violate its duty to this individual, or to this group of employees, then we tell the parties, we tell the union, we tell the people who filed the charge, we think there's a violation, and we try to work out a settlement. I mention groups of employees because there are some other issues that arise not in a grievance procedure, but maybe even in contract negotiations, or when you have a merger going on and the union is trying to decide how much seniority to allocate to this new group of employees who are being brought into the bargaining unit, and mm-hmm. how the union handles a tough political, a tough issue with political implications like that can also impact the duty of fair representation.
We're going to take a little break. We're speaking to Tom Good, resident officer of the Grand Rapids, Michigan office of the National Labor Relations Board. We're talking about the duty of fair representation. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor Stock Radio.
This is the sound of E. coli splashing around in raw hamburger juice on your cutting board. And it looks like Mom just put the tomatoes and onions on there, too. Don't let E. coli mosh with your food. An estimated 3,000 Americans die from a foodborne illness each year. So always separate raw meat from vegetables on two cutting boards. Keep your family safe at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
So, who's going to do what? Flashlights?
Nowhere to be found.
Emergency supply kits?
Not packed.
What about blankets?
We have an old towel.
Cell phones?
May not work.
Emergency water?
Not a drop.
Perfect. We all know where we're meeting if we're separated.
The library!
On Jones' house.
The bus stop.
And I'll be waiting here wondering where you all are. Great. It sounds like we don't have a plan.
Winging It is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency, who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 66, works with builders and contractors to build a better community. Local 66's tradesmen and women have received the specialty training needed to meet the complex challenges of any project, making them the most capable workforce in the region. From schools, highways, and pipeline projects to casinos and arenas, the operating engineers build any job, large or small. For over 100 years, Local 66 has provided superior service that our community can count on. They are your one-stop resource for qualified and productive operating engineers and heavy equipment mechanics. To learn more about the benefits of organized labor and more information about the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 66, go to www.iuoe66.org. That's www.iuoe66.org.
People are always looking to invest in a good opportunity. So what if you could invest in the future of kids, like a stock? Not the kind of stock that's about making money, but a stock for social change called Better Futures. With your investment, it helps students like me go to college. My name is Charles, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. Joining us today, we've got Buck Gino of Work in Progress Radio. Buck, welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Charles, getting into the last lap here.
Yeah, absolutely. Buck, you know, it is amazing to me, you know, not only are unions responsible to their members and everybody in the collective bargaining unit, but union officers themselves can be held responsible for the actions of the union.
Exactly.
We don't see that with corporations. Maybe we ought to ask our friend how we make that happen.
That's right. We have Tom Good with us from the National Labor Relations Board. He's the resident officer of the Grand Rapids, Michigan office. Tom, welcome to the show. We appreciate you joining us.
Hello, Buck, and hello, Charles. And Charles, I always appreciate your efforts to get me fired during one of these interviews.
It is not my effort to try and get you fired, but, you know, Tom, let's face it, you've been in the game for a long period of time.
But actually, though, right, Tom, the unions have they still retain some discretion, right, how they can choose to exercise this stuff, don't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, one of the lead cases, again, it was early in the history of the statute. It was a case that went to the Supreme Court called Ford Motor Company versus Huffman, a 1953 case. The court in that case said that the union did not breach its duty of fair representation when it agreed to grant seniority credit for military service, before someone was hired. This is just the union probably wanting to support the troops. Of course, there were a lot of veterans reentering the workforce after World War II and Korea, the Korean conflict. And at Ford, the union decided, we're going to give credit for the time you spent in the military before you were hired. And some employees challenged that, but the Supreme Court said, and this is a principle that exists today, that resounds to today. The court said that in negotiating a contract and in other representative functions, the union is entitled to exercise a wide range of reasonableness in agreeing to terms that might benefit one group of employees over another, as long as the union acts in good faith and honesty of purpose. And what that means is that, you know, the board is not, Supreme Court has said the board, NLRB, and the Railway Labor Act, the government is not supposed to be looking over the union's shoulder and telling it what we think is fair and what is not. I mean, there are some actions, some decisions that they make that we believe do violate the act, but we're not to substitute our judgment for the union's initial judgment. If they're trying to do right by the employees and showing honesty of purpose and good faith, generally that's going to be good enough to keep the union out of trouble with the NLRB.
You know, one of the things that I that's always a sticky situation, and we've been part of it these situations more times than I can remember, is contract negotiations. They can get rather sticky at times, and that, you know, oftentimes there can be a difference between the negotiating committee and what the actual membership thinks, and that can cause certain issues, correct?
Absolutely, and we've seen that. I've sat in this office and watched some employees who came in, and they were dead set against accepting the last best offer that an employer made, but the union, the bargaining committee, and perhaps even there was a ratification vote. Maybe there was a ratification vote, and maybe the majority of voting employees rejected the contract, and they were right at the point where they're going to have to go out on strike or are going to have to accept the contract. And the union committee said, you know, we know that the members rejected this. But we're going to exercise our judgment here that we can't take these people out on strike. We know that would be that might be the ruination of the bargaining unit. So we're going to sign this contract. It's a politically very difficult thing to do. But union, once again, if they're acting in what they see as the best interest of the bargaining unit, they're going to be okay with us. Now, there are a few contracts. We don't see very many of them, but there are some contracts that actually, in the contract itself, it requires ratification by a majority of the covered employees. We don't see those very often, but that would be a different case. If that's a condition that's built into the contract, the ratification vote would have to pass before the union could enter the contract.
You know, the other thing, too, that we see in the building trades, so we see this probably more than some of the others, such as grievances and things like that, is, most building trades offer or run basically what we call a hiring hall. Mm-hmm. And how does that work? Is there, you see many cases where, because when you're hiring people or employers are calling a union hall to hire employees, and most of them run it by a out-of-work list. Does that create some problems at times?
That's a very astute question, and the answer is that the duty of fair representation applies to exclusive hiring halls. That is, when the union hiring hall is the only source from which the employer can hire employees. Lots of employees and unions, believe, and even some employers believe that that's what they've got. When in fact, if you look at the language of the contract, the employer can hire from other sources, can hire off the street. But there sometimes we have to look at not just what is the letter of the contract, but what is the actual practice. If the reality of the situation is the employer exclusively uses the hiring hall for as its source of hiring employees, then the union may violate the duty of fair representation if it doesn't use objective criteria in referring employees out.
And what do you mean by objective criteria? The same
it could be seniority, skills. Of availability to the workplace, as long as they're not taking into account other irrelevant considerations like, are you pals with the local business agent? Have you been attending regular monthly meetings? Objective criteria relative to the job.
Well, this has been an interesting discussion, Tom. We do appreciate you being on. We'd like to give you a minute or so to remind all our not-yet-union brothers and sisters and anyone interested in the NLRB how they contact you and how they basically get you to check on if their rights are being violated.
I'll be happy to share that, but first let me just say I think it's to the credit of the Union Edge that we were able to cover this topic today, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The NLRB, we have a website where you can learn a lot about your rights under the Act, and you can now e-file petitions and charges, although I would suggest you, before you start doing that, call your local NLRB office to get some guidance or to answer questions about how to go about that. But if you go to www.nlrb.gov, you'll come to the website. That'll take you to the phone numbers of your local office. We have a nationwide toll-free number at 866-667-6572. That's 866-667-NLRB.
That being said, we've been talking to Tom Good, a resident officer of the National Labor Relations Board in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And for Charles Showalter, Angela Bachman, Brittany Sheets, and Laura Weens, I'm Buck Gino, and you've been listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.